Welcome to Alchemist X Innovators Inside, the podcast where we explore the world of corporate innovation and dive deep into the minds of thought leaders, high achievers, and risk takers. I'm your host, Ian Bergman, and together we'll uncover the challenges, triumphs, and secrets behind successful innovation journeys. Whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur, an industry veteran, or simply curious about the ever-evolving landscape of innovative ideas and what it takes to put them into practice, this is the podcast for you. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's embark on this exciting journey together. I couldn't be happier today to welcome you, Mike, to the show. Mike Gadsby is one of the founders and the chief innovation officer at O3 World, a Philadelphia-based customer experience consultancy that partners with organizations to design, prototype, and deploy innovative customer experiences. Now, Mike, those are my words, so I think pretty soon we're going to have to get to asking you to tell your story. But in the meantime, welcome to Innovators Inside. We're really glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. That's great. And your words, for the record, I would totally use your words. So I might hijack those eventually, but they're pretty consolidated. So I appreciate it.
Amazing. It wasn't even ChatGPT, which I feel like is a high compliment these days.
It is for sure.
Awesome. Well, let's actually start with your words. I'd like to help the audience get to know a little bit about you, who you are, but how you found yourself on this podcast today. So can you just share a little bit about your personal story, how you came up through a design and agency track, right, to do what you're doing now?
Yeah, totally. So back up to, God, so long ago now, graduated college in 2000, went to University of Pennsylvania. While I was in college, I had sort of picked up an interest in design, but then also in college, I had picked up an interest in web design, which at the time was
good timing.
Late 90s was still a bit of a new thing. I mean, I would have said it was a bit innovative then, although it just happened to be that's when like the first bubble was bursting. So, I don't know how many people were that into it. The irony of it at Penn was the only web design class that was being taught at the time happened to be a religious studies course. And I was, all right, well, I'm going to learn HTML, so that's fine. I'll take the class. I don't know why the cross-section and everything. Interesting, I still have the books. I was looking at them recently because of all this AI stuff that has popped up and talking about things like ethics and technology and uses and all this stuff. But I think what really got me was just that this was a new way to interact. It is fond of design as I am and really considered myself, I think, right out of the gate, if anything else, a multidisciplinary graphic designer. The thing I was most interested in was how people relate to design, to experiences, and ultimately that has driven my career since then. So fast forward several years, I had started freelancing on my own, I would say in 2003, quickly turned that into a business. Met my business partner, and we started O3 in 2005. And then we as an organization have really just grown up and evolved with essentially the internet and digital as a platform, right? We started out, it was, the internet was still just the Wild West. So it was really extensions of like advertising, extensions of marketing campaigns, extensions of all of that. And I would have said that, yeah, that was innovative at the time, but it was only innovative because it was a new channel. I wouldn't have necessarily called it particularly innovative. It was taking a lot of like ads and putting them on the internet,
Yay, banner ads. I remember those days.
Totally. I mean, I still remember building like first websites and like the craziest thing in the world was like a hover interaction over like a nav element. And you'd be like, whoa, look at that. I made it do a thing. Not very innovative, but really fun. That's really what this was all about. I think 2010 to like 2012 was when things started to like shape up for O3 as my company. And what we found was there was a real transition away from the web as an extension of brand marketing ad and actually more as a home base for businesses and organizations. This is when startup started to become a thing. Startup culture started to become a thing. You started to see models for developing businesses around the internet really start to develop. And we latched ourselves onto that. And that's really when we started to convert from, I would say, being, more just a design and development agency for the web to being a product designer and developer specifically. So we're doing a lot of app development, doing a lot of SaaS solutions, that sort of thing. And within all that, we started to find ourselves very much within the R&D space within these organizations. A lot of like the mobile apps that would come out, we were really driven by organizations thinking like, okay, well, how do we come up with new ways to engage with customers? How do we come up with whole new revenue streams? And that sort of paved the path for us to start to be attached to the hip with a lot of these innovation sectors within these various companies we were doing business with. Now, they've all taken different models. They've all taken different tactics for what they do. Some function as accelerators, some function as, you know, in-house entrepreneurial programs, right? And they're all sort of different. And through all that, you know, personally, you know, I've learned a lot about how to define and I guess, mystifying. Is that a word?
It is now.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Define innovation. And, you know, I suppose that's how I, you know, picked up innovation as a skill set. You know, we learned a lot about, you know, models to drive innovation. We learned a lot about how, you know, there's differences between incremental innovation and really, you know, big splashy ideas.
Yep.
And, you know, and now we're just sort of helping a lot of companies figure it out as we kind of go along. So it's been a lot of fun.
Oh, that's amazing. And I want to come back to that kind of incremental innovation, this notion of, I think this notion of sort of sustaining innovation often gets overlooked in favor of the big splashy stuff. But, you know, before we get there, so let's just sort of recap, you know, you're embedded with your partner companies, right, that are trying to figure out how to do something new, how to stay competitive, how to reach their customers in new ways. And you're helping them both think through their innovation methods and framework, as well as taking it to prototyping, design, development, and beyond. Is that right?
That is right. So I'd say, you know, our roots have always been in solutions. Our roots have always been in, you know, rubber meets the road, you know, design, development. How do we bring something to life? The thing we found out over years of doing this work, and really all of the work that we do, is you don't know what you have until you put something in front of people that they can use, that they can react to. You can call something a million different things. Even the word innovation has like, I mean, I use it, and then like people are like, they roll their eyes because it can have a million different meanings, right?
Well, sure.
The same goes when these, you know, you get the people who come in and say, hey, I want to build, it's Uber for whatever industry, right? And you're like, yeah, all right, but like, well, let's get in the weeds on that a little bit. You have to actually like build something and have people react to it to really know what you have. So yeah, that is a big portion of the solutions we provide is not just conceptualizing an idea, but helping to actually visualize it and bring it to life.
I love that. Well, and to your point, you know, you mentioned the emergence of sort of what we understand to be modern startup culture, but isn't that so much of what modern startup culture is, right? The tools and technologies are there to rapidly build, prototype something, throw it out there, see what sticks, learn and iterate. And that does drive innovation.
Yeah, 100%. And I would argue though, too, is I think there's, it's funny to me because I've always been a big fan of understand a model, break a model, right? Like, because as much as these models have become models, there's so much to learn from, going to build a thing a certain way and then realizing, well, there was probably 50 other ways we could have done this and gotten sure. It to market faster and thought through it faster, right? We haven't gotten to this yet, but like with the emergence of AI and automation now too, like the idea of like, can we get more ideas out there faster? Can we test things a lot quicker? Can we start thinking about our processes in a different way? You know, to me, it's just going to completely supercharge a lot of these models and kind of where we're at now versus where we're going down the road.
I love it. All right. Well, we're going to get to kind of the knockout match on, you know, what the most exciting innovation or technology trend is today. But first, let's do a definition.
Yep.
Let's do a misdefinition. What's innovation in your mind, Mike?
Well, I'll tell you what it's not. And let's start there and then we can back into a definition. What we found out over the years and what I think is really obvious, but maybe it's not, is innovation isn't technology, right? It's not these, you know, tools of the trade that are redefining our engagement. It's not the metaverse. It's not AI. It's not, you know,
hover actions on the website.
Right. It's not AR or VR. None of that ultimately really matters. What innovation is, at the end of the day, is solving problems in new and compelling ways, whereby outcomes that you're hoping to achieve are far greater, right? So the example I always use with people is like, you know, a book I read a while back, and forgive me, I forget the author's name, but is The Best Interface is No Interface. And it's such a great model for like, it was like, it's written when like, there was an app for that, right? That came out and everyone was building an app for something. And the first example he uses is, I guess BMW came out with an app to like open and close the car. And he was talking about how ridiculous it was. He's like, okay, let me get this straight. I'm going to walk up to my car. I'm going to bring out my phone. I'm going to log into my phone. I'm going to go find the app. I'm going to find the app, go to the screen that has the key, and then I'm going to hit the key and open the door. Or I'm just going to pull out my key and open the door. And it's such an interesting way of looking at it. It's like, no, the innovation really is in how do I open that door faster, easier, mm-hmm. make the experience better, right? That's really where you're providing the innovation. The innovation would be in, you know, keyless entry and for me to not have to use a key at all and sit in my car and get it started in the whole nine, which you've seen a lot of that since then. But that to me is really what we're talking about. New and novel ways to solve problems and to improve experiences. We're an experience-centric company. Everything we do is about improving experiences, whether they're customer experiences, patient experiences, employee experiences, you name it. But that's really what we're focused on is how do we get people to be happier, less friction filled experiences, and ultimately make their lives better.
I love that definition, right? And it's interesting because it actually does draw on one of your earlier comments, right? The new tool, the hover click, the stick, the AR glasses, in and of themselves don't drive innovation. But when you combine pains and problems that people feel, like it takes me extra steps to get into my car, I have to find my keys, et cetera, with the art of what's possible in emerging technologies, right? Bluetooth LE, universal, ubiquitous smartphones, a little bit of iteration beyond that first BMW experience. All of a sudden you do get, as you say, seamless keyless entry, right? That is secure and authenticated. And that's innovation. And that's amazing.
Spot on. You have to be focused on understanding and solving the problem. And not in simply generating, you know, a new experience, right? Like you have to be really thoughtful about that in order to really make change and really, to me, find the new opportunities to improve your status, whether that's a business or whatever. So,
you know, there's something else that I think that's a great framing for innovation. There's something else that I think is missing from these conversations so often, right? You have to have the vision. You have to have that experience focus. You also have to do something else you alluded to, right? You have to take action. You actually have to do something.
Well, and I think this is where some of the older models fall apart is in, you know, and this is really where we battle that idea of incremental innovation versus big splashes and where do you go from there. I think sometimes people get lost in their processes whereby they forget that like the most important thing is to get something in front of people and having them reacting to it, using it, enjoying it and ultimately or hating it and ultimately providing that feedback loop. It is the most important thing. And without it, you're just sort of, you know, thinking about ideas or you're potentially moving in the wrong direction. But I'll say this, you know, I think it's also important that I sort of alluded to this before that, you know, when we're thinking about what to put in front of people, we're thinking about it and it's as complete an experience as we can get to. I remember the days of like paper prototyping and stuff. And it's funny to me that there's probably a time and a place for a lot of this stuff. And I'm like, we have tools in front of us now to build out like damn near whole experiences in record time. And, you know, we need to be embracing that. So just as much as it is about, you know, rubber meets the road, putting something in front of people, it is about making sure that we're being really thoughtful about the tooling, the things that we have at our disposal in order to get those more complete experiences in front of people. Because I, in my mind, the more you can get a complete picture of what you're trying to deliver, the more you can really deliver on big innovation versus, you know, small steps in the right direction.
Well, I love that. And I feel like this is a natural segue to you know, that tool that everyone believes is going to solve all of the problems in the world. So can we chat a bit about AI, specifically generative AI, and how that's a tool that you're seeing being used, misused, perceived, misperceived, whatever language you want to use around it these days?
Oh, boy. All right, let's start to unpack this. So
yeah, let's go.
All right. So let's start at the highest level. And I'll just sort of give my perspective on what Gen AI means for like the world and experiences at large. And again, I'm not an engineer, so I don't look at this very, very much from like, I mean, the technology behind it, I understand it. It's very interesting. Large language models in general, when we think about ChatGPT particularly, are really compelling and for a million reasons. But I think the biggest thing to sort of just take a step back from and look at all of this from, they still, like anything else, have to be considered within the context of the experiences we're trying to create and deliver. Whether that's internally for workflow experiences, whether it's externally as we engage with customers or clients or patients or what have you, like there's so much that needs to be focused on that before we even bring AI to the table. It is a big part of the workshops that we conduct is really to start with, let's not even talk about AI. We're going to get to AI, but we're going to talk about this first, which is generally like, how do we fix or identifying friction and experiences and then looking at those as opportunities. But once we get to the AI table, then it's a matter of understanding the use cases to begin with, right? And for us, particularly as we're thinking about generative AI, we look at it, I mean, there's a lot of categories here, but the four we're really looking at is first in personalization and personalizing experiences. I think this is a space that has been talked about a lot, particularly in marketing circles. You have these personalization engines that come out and you have a ton of different tools that have been developed and redeveloped and bought and purchased in the market. But the reality is like they're all kind of like half a promise. They do some stuff really well, but the AI engines behind them, frankly, aren't that fantastic, in my opinion. They require huge data sets to make decisions and to push people in certain directions. But reality is like if you don't have that much traffic, you're a B2B company and you're not on par with a giant, billion-dollar retail organization. Like that scale becomes a problem. The promise of Gen AI now and what we're seeing is the ability to really then on a very little amount of data. And honestly, not a whole heck of a lot that we can inject, almost hyper-personalized down to the individual because of how the models are built. That's a huge deal. That allows us to create experiences that like we were thinking about for the last 10, 15 years. I would give talks on. I was looking back. I gave a talk in 2017 about this stuff. And then it was it. And I remember thinking to myself, well, all right, let's get to work. And
so we just went from, wouldn't it be cool to, wait a second, there's a tool. Yeah.
Oh, totally. And that's a big part of it. I think the second part is we look at conversation as a big driver. How people interact with the digital world has been fundamentally driven by our ability to, deliver certain types of experiences. I think back to when I was starting out in web design and, when we were designing buttons and search fields and how forms look and all these other things. And we were developing these like user experience conventions like out of nothing, when the reality was like, it was the best we had, right? Like that's, if you wanted to put a button in a place, you put a button in a place because we wanted somebody to interact with it. As user experience became a field, then there was like a lot of like best practices. Well, the search bar should go here. The nav should go here. How we structure our content should go a certain way. The fact of the matter is like, if you think about how you want to interact with a brand and you think about a personal experience therein, like, wouldn't you want to just have a conversation to a degree? Like if I go into a store in a retail experience, right? The experience I use all the time is like if I'm doing a kitchen renovation, which is something I did, many years ago, and was actually a very good experience. But there were like a million people involved. It was a very like offline experience, and it was just complicated. And I kept thinking to myself like, wow, wouldn't it be great if like I could just have this interaction more in a digital capacity? All of this conversation can contextually be captured and reassessed, and then it gets predictive. Okay, well you like this, so hey, logo, look at these things, right? And now that's very possible with this sort of these large language models and what's available to us, which I think is pretty amazing. A third is really though is what I was sort of getting at was really around prediction. And prediction in particular, you know, to me is always one of those things where it's like, you know, I don't need you to tell me where the stock market's going. I just need you to have a bit of a proactive.
You just want that.
Yeah, right. I mean, that would be good for my, you know, financial well-being. But when I think about it from a user experience perspective, I just want someone to be proactive, right? I just want to know that, like, when I get to a situation, you already know me, you're already in front of it, you already have things all set up for me, I'm ready to go. I don't have to think about, you know, trying too hard at any one particular thing. I think that's a big part of what they offer as well. And then the last is really around workflow improvements. You know, I can't begin to tell you how much I believe, you know, there's a lot of concern about replacing jobs with AI. And I read a quote the other day, and I think it's the right perspective on this. It's you're not going to get replaced by AI. You're going to get replaced by people who know how to use AI to do right. their jobs, right? Like, it's like any other technology that has come before it in that regard, and that it makes us more efficient, makes us faster, makes us more comprehensive. But it's at a point now where I just don't think you've seen anything like it prior. So anyways, that was extremely long-winded, but at least you got our perspective on it, kind of where we're coming from.
Well, and it is really interesting. And obviously, this is one of those conversations where it is incredibly hard to parse out sort of the hype versus what's possible today, to break that apart from ethics, to break that apart from, like, mm-hmm. societal shifts that are going to happen and all that good stuff. We won't go down that path now, maybe in a few minutes, but you did say something that I think is actually really interesting. You talked about the conversational element of AI, and you talked about the experience. And as I reflect on the last couple decades of technology and how that has intersected with sort of the relationship between, you know, brands, organizations, and their end customers, you often come back to this question of, I just want to talk to a person. I just want to talk to a human. And one of the things that I've been observing and is really interesting to me, it's what's behind that, right? When I want to talk to a person, it's not because I love talking to people, right? Actually, a lot of the time I hate talking to people. It's because I expect them to come with the ability to have context, the ability to predict, the expertise to be able to solve a problem. Right. And I think it's really interesting as you combine basically three of the four points that you just said, you start to see a path where technology can finally start to deliver on the promise of being able to interact with a customer, with a person in a way that understands them, that is human, that is sort of emotionally understanding, but more importantly, is effective, efficient, and doesn't make a customer, a partner, an employee feel like a cog in a machine that is just churning on regardless of what's going on around it. Does that seem fair?
Oh, I would say it's 100% spot on. If I can tack onto it for a second, just to provide, I think, an example that we look at a lot, chatbots in general. Like, I mean, it's funny to me because the idea of a chatbot is a really, like, foundationally, it's a really good idea. We're going to automate 90% of the conversations that we have. So think about it as in a retail experience, right? Like, 90% of our customers ask the same questions over and over again. Why would we have a customer service representative waste their time with that? Let's just make sure the interactions they're having are going to be quality interactions where they can provide a lot of value, and then all of these, like, tedious tasks can get handled by the bot. The problem is those bots were always so poor. You can go to any website now in any retail experience and you're going to get, I don't know, maybe a 20% actual success rate. And by that, I mean that, like, an issue was resolved by not having to, like, contact somebody in customer support. I went through one recently, and it was really just as a test to because I hadn't been on one in a while. And, you know, I threw in, you know, my example of my home improvement project. And, you know, I got dished off to a customer service rep, like, right away. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't mind talking to people. I got to be honest
Absolutely.
With you. That's fine. But, like, that's not what I was expecting out of the bot either. Right. And the sad fact is, over the last, like, 10 years, as these things have become more and more of a thing, that's about as good as they're going to deliver, because that's about as good as the technology was. They were decision agents. They were going to just do if this, then that sort of scenarios. But now, wow, we can really start to have these like really in-depth discussions, and you're delivering a more human experience. I think your point is spot on there. And I think that what that does is it changes my expectation as a consumer, as a just a human who's going to interact with the digital world about what I'm going to get out of this. You know, all of a sudden it's like, well, I can go 3-4 levels deeper in this conversation. Oof, what can I actually accomplish? So I do think we are now shifting quite a bit, and I think it keep taking note of that. I think is in everybody's best interest.
I think that's amazing. I think it's insightful, and it speaks to the fact that, you know, durable pain points sometimes are just waiting on the new tools so that you can actually drive real innovation. I got to tell you, you're dredging up some painful memories. We talk about with this chatbot stuff. We talk about learning from failure. I tried to put out a chatbot maybe 6-7 years ago to a large customer support scenario. I was at Microsoft. We were dealing with thousands and thousands of partners and vendors who had what we thought were simple questions. And, you know, those decision trees fork and fork and fork and fork.
You can't manage, there are no conversations that are legitimately linear. They're just not.
When there's no inference, when there's no ability to kind of predict, what happens is you just end up putting your customer in some box that is 70% of what they meant, and they get really mad at you and you get mad at them. And that's not good for anyone.
No.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day too, it's not even that. So there's two ways to look at this. One, it's delivering on the promise of the experience. But two, which I think is, you know, once you sort of start to scratch that surface a little bit and then really start to deliver on it, it's then the opportunities you open up. There are things that, you know, we're starting to think about right now, types of interactions, really complex scenarios that we wouldn't even come close to approaching because it was like, they can't do that. Well, now we're like, well, if we can do this, then all right, now we start opening up some doors for more complex interactions. It really does start to make you think about what's possible, for sure.
I love it. Okay, so we got to be customer focused or scenario focused when thinking about innovation. We love to kind of tackle big pain points. That said, it ain't easy. So let's talk about this. Like, what you have the best idea in the world, but what makes it hard to actually get this done with the partners and clients that you work with?
So I always try to tell stories just to sort of relate this stuff. And I think a very good one is, you know, without naming names here, but thinking about startups that I've, you know, engaged with in the past. And it's so funny to me when they come to the table with something that you look at and you're like, that's an ace. That's a great idea. They are going to kill it. And then you find out after you built it, you tested, you iterated, you did all the things right, and you got a product that's in market, and it's just not sticking with people, right? And it's just not doing the thing that you wanted it to do. And the reality is sometimes, you know, sometimes it's just dumb luck, right? Sometimes you're just like, hey, you know, you got to hit the thing at the right time with the right people, etc. But I think more than not, there are subtle changes and subtle differences in how you approach particular problems that really do make or break you. An example of that would be, I'll tell you what, a simple idea here, but like something that we address right out of the gate when we think about engagement with customer bases is like the decision on whether or not I'm in a mobile environment or a web environment, right? Sounds simple enough. Well, we can go look at data and we can go say, all right, well, 60% of the people are going to interact here and blah, blah. Well, there are so many types of products that get built where you have complex interaction scenarios where it's not just a direct to one individual. You might have 10 people involved, and those 10 people might be, you know, wandering around this experience in various ways at various times of day. And so what you find is that your bet is not a wrong bet, but the reality is like it's just a little different than what you anticipated. But, you know, those little lefts and those little rights can be really expensive decisions to make. And then all of a sudden you're having to like rethink architecture and rethink this and rethink that. And that's just unfortunate. I think the necessity within innovation is just expecting the fact that sometimes you're going to get that wrong. And then you have to sort of scramble to get to where you're going to get to, right? That's what makes it hard. In my mind, that's what makes it hard, is those decisions aren't quick and simple. Like you're not just nailing it right out of the gate. I don't care how good an idea is.
Well, and I think that's actually a really interesting point, right? There's a lot of innovation where you focus on the one big thing, the one big decision, you place all your chips on the table and, you know, you kind of think, oh, if this doesn't work, I've failed. And what you're saying is iteration is required no matter what. Iteration is required, learning from the things that didn't work. How does that sort of jive with the types of companies that you find yourself working with? Is this something that's culturally accepted? Is this something you have to explain?
It depends on the organization for sure. And I will say so we, as I mentioned early in the process, we deal with a lot of different types of innovation teams and new product and R&D teams. They all function a little bit differently. And some of them function very much as, you know, a satellite to the main organization. Some of them are really deeply embedded into product teams and that sort of thing. And I think and some are successful in various capacities more than others. And I think some of it comes down to culturally how well aligned the organization is around how innovation functions. If you're okay with the fact that learning is an asset, that you're going to find out things that are going to ultimately be beneficial to the organization, that insight is a data point that is going to be that is going to have, you know, a monetary value, I think those orgs are okay, because then they understand that like innovation is a process and it's not a thing that you're going to just nail out of the gate.
How many of those organizations are out there? Because that's wonderful, but like,
yeah, I will say I find that the companies that where they were either founded or have made top-down decisions to really embrace and commit to innovation as a key component of their business, whereby they are continuously looking for new revenue opportunities to support the mothership, as it were. I think those companies do all right, because then at the end of the day, like they're not repelled by like, you know, hey, we did a thing, we put it out in the market, it failed miserably, you know, and they're like, okay, well then we won't do that again. I guess we'll move on to the next thing, right? But they also have very refined processes for making sure that the risks that they take are mitigated, you know, so that they're not making, you know, huge investments into something and watching it fall on its face. They're going to make modest investments, and those modest investments are going to turn into more moderate investments. And then over time, then they become big investments once they've sort of figured some things out and they can prove business cases and all of that. So I find that those definitely are the companies that have done the best with it. The ones whereby they think they have to be innovative, so they create innovation teams, but their expectations are such that, you know, that, okay, well, we'll get a 1 in 5 bet here and it's going to be a big moneymaker. And then they're looking at revenue opportunities as like the only outcome. That's tough, because that's, in my mind, that's like gambling, right? Like you're putting everything on red and hoping it all works out. And it's like, that's not what this is about. It's about building processes that and really having outcomes that are really well aligned. So again, it really comes down to the organization, but there are definitely ones that are doing it right. And certainly in our portfolio clients, quite a few that I've been very impressed with.
That's amazing. And that, you know, I'm just going to echo that point on processes. I'm going to kind of layer in that note on sort of it's a culture thing, a recognition of iteration and acceptance of failure. And to your point, the commercial value of the data that you gather and learn makes a lot of sense. And it's funny because there are, I think the world doesn't give necessarily enough credit to some of these big organizations that make big swings, right? They've built it into their DNA. They make big swings and they miss, and they acknowledge that miss and they learn from it, right? And I mean, whether it's launching Crystal Pepsi, however, that was a fun one from 25 years ago that didn't work out.
I just saw a whole thing on that, by the way. I was watching. Yeah, it was all about like these like horrible like failures of innovations, and yeah, that Crystal Pepsi was like number one. And you know what I forgot about on that was it was Van Halen. that did the, they had, they took, I forget what the song was, but it was, you know, I forget which lead singer it was, but definitely not the main guy. Right. And I just remember seeing those commercials from back in the day and being like, this looks terrible.
Well, you know what's funny? I that wasn't even planned. I just kind of pulled that out of nowhere. It was in the back of my mind, right? Yeah. But it's really funny. Now I want to see whatever you saw. I need to go back and watch those commercials, right? But like, boy, was that a learning moment, right, for Pepsi. Or you can go to more modern ones. Like, I think Amazon is kind of canonical in tech circles as an example of a company that's willing to take big swings, launch a phone that turns out to be terrible, learn from it, pull it, right? There's something there, and there is something to that balance of being willing to take the big swings, understand they're not all going to pay off, while also building the methodology and the infrastructure to give yourself conviction and confidence, you know, that there's something here.
Yeah, for sure. And I would say this though too, going back to our sort of conversation about incremental innovation, this is also where, you know, I don't know, I gotta be honest, I don't know that I have like the math and the model here all worked out in my head around like what's the right answer between the balance of incremental innovation versus the big swings. But I do know it's not one or the other. Right. I do know it's definitely necessary to, you know, understand where the big value lies in, you know, what you're doing in the market versus just trying to take, you know, a point here or there by making small adjustments. Right. They're both necessary to a degree, but I do think that's the $1 million question, or sometimes the $1 billion question. Right.
When you trillion get into
things is, yeah, that's right, trillion, right, is really trying to find that balance between like, okay, I have a product idea. The big idea I've proven to a degree, it's the little ideas within the big idea now that I have to bear out to get to something that's going to be sustainable long term. Yeah, that's the trick of it all. And that's really where I think that's the hard work too.
It really is. And I like your point on there being a balancing act. I'll reiterate something I think I said earlier. I feel like this is a soapbox item of mine, but like, I think that sort of sustaining incremental innovation is underappreciated. I think a lot of organizations underinvest in that, in the face of, I need the big swing. I need the new billion, you know, $50 billion opportunity, or, you know, I need to reinvent my entire business, right? Because something fundamental is changing in the world around me. That's important. There aren't that many examples of companies that have really successfully taken a really big swing and, you know, reinvented themselves, right?
Certainly not reinvented themselves, but I will say, I think the one thing you're seeing quite a bit now with the companies that have sustained growth is they have built models whereby they have a capacity to evolve quickly. Netflix, I think, is a great example of this, right? Where like Netflix was exactly the opposite of Blockbuster, right? It came out, it made it easier for people to get content. But what they saw early on was that like that was going to go away too. And I remember, I think it was just recently, they shut down their like disc in the mail service, right?
How long do people even know that was still around?
Yeah. No idea. But I mean, it was funny. I was like, wow. I was like, let's think about this, right? I remember that very vividly of like that making that change from Blockbuster, which, listen, there was something to be said too about going to the Blockbuster and choosing the VHS tape, and that there was limited availability, especially on a Friday night, right? Like, there was something to all that. Like, there was an interesting part of the experience. But as it sort of evolved, like, Blockbuster had no plan B or C.
Right.
But if I think about what they've done, recognizing not just that it was not just about content distribution, but then they became about content development, owning the content, creating their own content, creating award-winning content. Like, wow. Talk about, like, seeing down the road, right? That to me is the new big idea. It's not the individual ideas per se. It's seeing what the 10-year, 20-year, 30-year roadmaps look like. We asked about innovation earlier. That's why I think innovation is so important. It's about sustainability as an organization. It's about making sure that there's going to be an org of some sort 5 to 10 years from now. Frankly, for my own business, it is the thing that I think I can really feel confident about. We've hang our hat on. We've been in business 18 years. we've grown every year, and we found success every year. And even during the pandemic, I mean, we did all right, because I think that we've set ourselves up to constantly be looking for the next thing. And where are we going to go next? I just think that that's the most important part of like the big innovation. It's not a matter of like the iPhone coming out every year. I mean, that's only going to happen every so often. But now you're in a spot where you're going to start to see what happens over time.
It's a great point. And so let's dig deep into the wisdom of Mike here, right? So what pearl of wisdom, what piece of advice would you give to an executive who wants to set their organization up for this type of thinking?
Right. So first and foremost, I think that any executive who's sort of thinking about innovation has to be looking at it through the lens of what's coming next for my company. And I think in that case, you have to be extremely customer centric. You have to look at this through the eyes of what are people going to want 5 to 10 years from now? What does it look like now? And yes, it's a little bit of forecasting, a little bit of futurism, if you will. But I do think that that's a big part of this. It's just grounding yourself in the fact that this has to be about, you know, not just the products you're selling or the services you're creating, but it has to be about like the why behind it, and that you're servicing, you know, an individual or a group of individuals who need it to some degree. And then really thinking about where their needs at now versus where their needs going to be. I go back to what I was said earlier up front, like all the technology in the world is not going to address that issue. That is a foundational issue that needs to change. One of the examples I like to use all the time is like, you look at the S&P 500, you look at the leaders right across the board now, right? Biggest companies in the world now are technology companies, but they're not technology companies. They're experience companies. They're Apple, they're Amazon, they're Google, right? If you look at the biggest companies in the world 20 years ago, they were energy companies. Right? They were the companies that helped us get from A to B. Now it's a matter of the companies that are really taking account of their customer experience, the companies that have really figured out that like, if people don't spend money, you won't have the largest company in the world, and really building their businesses around that. I think that's the first thing. I think if organizations can get centered around humans, can get centered around their customers, I think they're in a good shape. I think tangentially, I think the best customer experiences relate to the best employee experiences. I think when you have great employee experiences, you're going to deliver great customer experiences. I think if you can get centered around that as well, and like, how do we make it so that our employees are the biggest, baddest ass version of themselves, right? And when they go interface with your customers, I think you got it so like figured out. Then you can get to technology. Then you can get to products. Then you can get to the formation of the services and all of that. Once you've sort of figured out those beginning parts, then it's a matter of how do I fill in the gaps? Where do I find the innovation? I was on a panel a few years back, a speaker from Google. I unfortunately forget the guy's name, but he was great. And he had this great line. He said, "I believe innovation exists in the gaps between experiences." And I was like, oh, my mind melted out of my ears. I was like, oh, that's a good line. That's a really good line. And he nailed it as far as I'm concerned, because what he sort of mapped out and he visualized there was that there was those gaps in the experience we just haven't figured out yet, right? Like, and that we were talking about AI earlier. Like, all that's doing is really creating the glue and really bringing it together, really making it easier for people to do the things that they want to do, and more exciting and hopefully more delightful, right? So if you start with the people, right, and you think about where you can sort of fix some problems, and then you weave in some of these more interesting type solutions, I think that's the biggest thing that execs can do.
I love it. And so I have one more question for you in this vein. I'm hoping this one's not a hardball for you, a fastball. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. But
curveball, maybe it's a slider. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah, exactly.
you can tell I'm a soccer guy. So, but you know, we talked about the executive. They have span of control, authority, et cetera. What about that kind of maybe more junior person? What about that person who sees something they want to solve in the world, wants to be an innovation agitator, but maybe doesn't have the span of control within their organization. What pearls of wisdom would you have for that person?
Oh man, I mentor a lot of people in this regard. Matter of fact, I had a high school student in yesterday, and she was really interested in becoming an experience designer. And so, all right, you can, you know, come in and learn something for a day. And the thing I expressed to her, and the thing that I'll express to just about anybody, you know, regardless of where they're at in their careers, just because you're not like given like the executive position, it doesn't mean you can't be a leader, right? It doesn't mean you can't look for opportunities. I think the thing that separates out the innovators from everybody else is their capacity to see 4 or 5 years down the road and their desire to chase that. I think anybody who's willing to put ideas in front of their boss, in front of their team, in front of, you know, whoever's willing to listen, but ground it in, you know, objective thinking, right? We as an organization are trying to accomplish X, Y, and Z. I see a problem here. If we did this, then we can, you know, go find that objective this much faster. Like anybody can go do that. Like as long as you have the information to some degree, and maybe that's some of the holdup, right, is having access to that. Although I will say, one of the things I tell everybody is, listen, not every company is going to be the most transparent company in the world. Your financial services company, insurance company, something like that. There's only so much you can tell everybody at the company. But most of the best companies in the world are very transparent in a lot of what they're trying to accomplish, because they recognize that if we're going to create goals, those goals have to trickle down into everyone in the organization in order for everyone to be pushing in the same direction, right? That's just great management. Like that's how that's supposed to work. But as any individual has those objectives and knows what the company is supposed to do, in my mind, you have all the tools necessary then to go find those opportunities to put that back in front of people. And I think it's imperative. And for our company, I can tell you that, like, you know, we have a hierarchy just like anybody else. I know there's a lot of flat organizations out there, but there's still a hierarchy, I believe, even in flat organizations. But I think the most important thing is that you create avenues whereby those individuals can find problems and express themselves about how to solve those problems. And I think as long as that's on the table, you're in a good spot. You'll have an opportunity to push things forward. I remember my first job out of college, I was working for a little brand design company up in New York, and it was fantastic. We had huge clients, small company, 10 people. We were working with Disney and GM and Campbell's and Co. I mean, huge brands. And the thing that I was so fascinated with my job at the time, that like all I wanted to do was my job. Like I would get home from work, I would take work home, and I would ask people who were working on other projects, could I try that? I'll take it home and I just want to try this thing, because like I want to see how do I do on this, because it looks interesting. It looks like an interesting problem to solve. Lord knows I don't have that kind of time these days, and Lord knows I got a lot of other things going on. But that mindset, I think, is one that any individual can take on. Give me a problem to solve, whether it's technically my problem or not, and I'm going to go try it out. I'm going to go flex my muscles. Maybe I do a terrible job with it. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, that you're trying to solve the problem is what's important.
Because why not? Well, and you're self-motivated. You're driven by what your curiosity, your ambition, your goals, whatever they might be. But I think that's a really interesting point. And to an extent, it also just kind of boils down to, you know, you have the right to do it. Go do it, right? Whatever that thing is.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
That's great advice. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure of a conversation. We've gone a little long. We're kind of coming up on our hour here, but I didn't want to cut things short. It's been really interesting. I think I have maybe just a couple of closing questions, and then I don't know if there's anything else you want to throw out there, but let's get this one out of the way. What's next for you? For O3 World, tell me about the next month, year, decade of your life.
I will say this, and I know as much as I've touted this whole like AI is just a tool, let's not focus on the AI thing. I will maybe sound a little hypocritical here in saying that we are also at, I believe, a point in time that the world has not seen. And I try not to be hyperbolic about this, because I actually look myself in the mirror every now and then and go, like, am I making a mountain out of a molehill? Is this like anything else? And I don't think it is. And I'll tell you why, is because I think that what I have seen is so fundamentally game changing in every aspect of sort of life, how we work, how we're going to engage with our kids, how we're going to engage with our healthcare providers, how we're going to engage with just about any other individual on earth, that I'm like, wow, I'm like, this is pretty game changing stuff. That being said, I fully believe that the road to the work that we're doing, or really any work that you're doing, is going to have to embrace some form of AI strategy, if you will, to really not only take the lead in certain regards, right? It can be differentiating for a period of time here, but honestly, to keep up. I think there's going to come a point in time in the next, call it 12 months, 2 years, where your AI skill set is going to be incredibly important. It's going to be one of those things that people look at and they go, you know, on a resume, and like, well, what are you doing to make yourself more efficient and more effective over the course of the day? How are you turning 8 hours of work into 2 hours of work, right? Like, how are you just doing the creative work, just being strategic, just thinking about the bigger architecture versus, you know, just knocking out a bunch of tedious stuff? That's different. And that's going to change a lot of how we engage with clients, how those clients engage with their customers. And I think it's one of those areas that, like, we have to be extremely thoughtful on, like, how we're approaching this. What are our methods to delivering on the work we've done for so many years? How are we then training or retraining individuals to embrace this as a way of doing their work, right? I think there's just so many little elements in there that are on the table. One, it is so exciting. I have loved my job more in the last year, or I would say 6 months to a year, and been more excited about it than I have been since I was like really young in my career, right? Like it's and I've always loved my job. So like, that's not like a thing to say. It's just to say that, like, I wake up in the morning, I'm like, wow, what's next today? My mind is blown now every day with what I'm seeing and the stuff that's being put in front of us. So I do think sort of what's next is really figuring out how to not just navigate all this stuff, but really figure out how to use it as a compass to finding the new versions of my own business and then all of the people we consult with.
Well, look, that's a great answer for you. I also think it's great advice for everyone listening to this and everyone we talk to, because you go play with these tools, go play with these technologies. They are accessible to anyone.
Accessible. They're out there. There's like no excuse not to go try these things out. Like, get to know them. I was talking to my mom the other day. I was like, Mom, my mom's in her 70s and she still works like crazy. She's literally given me my work ethic over my life. And I'm like, Mom, do you use ChatGPT? And she's like, no, I don't AI. What is that all about? And I'm like, just like, figure out like a handful of tasks that you do that like you hate doing, right? Like that's just the stuff that's just tedious that you're like, I just want to be done my day. Like, I don't want to be sending the 50th email today. So she hasn't done it yet, but I gave her like a laundry list of things to do. And I'm thinking to myself, like, that's just a good place to start, right? Like, realize what the use cases could be and just go give it a whirl, you know, just go give it a try.
And just see what happens. Absolutely. It is great advice. Well, Mike, what is the best way for our listeners to connect with you or follow your work? Are you on Twitter? Do you stand on a street corner in Philly shouting on Fridays?
No, I do not do. Well, maybe I do that, but that's not for people to want to engage with me on. Definitely, you know, if you want to come to a Philadelphia sports game in some capacity or another, I'm generally at those. But I will say this, LinkedIn for sure. Mike Gadsby, 03, and you can find me on there poking around and putting up a lot of thought leadership. But then just in general, I mean, 03world.com is our website, and you can connect with us there. you know, on there, and I work with a ton of really smart people too. And you know, depending on what you're trying to get into, we could certainly align you with quite a few folks as well. So
amazing. Well, I can attest to that statement. Mike, thank you so much for joining us on Innovators Inside. This is super fun.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoy these conversations more than anything these days. This is not even work. This is just a ton of fun. And you know, I really appreciate having me.
Awesome. Have a great rest of your week. Cheers.
So that's a wrap for today's episode of Alchemist X Innovators Inside. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you found value and insight in today's discussion, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone who is passionate about corporate innovation or just curious about great ideas and practical insights. Until next time, I'm Ian Bergman. Thanks for tuning in.